A number of years ago, I was in a little town, Darjeeling, on the northern boundary of India, where it met Tibet. And there were several visitors from various countries, and the hotel management decided it would be appropriate to give a little entertainment in the Tibetan spirit. So they brought in about a half a dozen Tibetan dancers with their masks and regalia to entertain. And among them was a little boy about 8 years old, a very cute, chubby little rascal, and everyone liked immediately. But when the time for the dance came, he put on one of the most grotesque masks you'd ever want to see. He really was, it looked like a nightmare. And, of course, everyone knew it was the little boy. But during the dance, he started and moved over very rapidly towards the audiences, always getting ready to attack them. And you should have seen the audience scatter. They all knew it was the little boy, but with the mask, something happened. And a real spirit of ancient and primary fear moved in on those people. They actually, subconsciously, were terrified. On another occasion, I remember in the Japanese no drama, where the principal actors are masked, many of the themes are highly sacred. And in the various performances, the actors are nearly always concealed behind these wood-carved masks that are well-painted and decorated, but of course have no expression except that of the original carving. But under a careful handling of lights, particularly by the postures of the head in relationship to the source of light, these faces seem to change. And in moments of joy, the face really seemed to smile. And in sorrow, the face looked very tragic. And yet it was done with a wooden mask, but everyone felt it. The skill with which the mask was handled was the principal factor. In the southwest of the United States, we have a series of ritualistic dances by the various Indian tribes, the Zunis, Hopis, Navajo. These dances often include masked figures, and everyone knows that these masked figures are members of the local community. One of the men with a mask, very carefully developed, rather crude mask concealment, actually has two children in the audience. They all know that it's father. But when he dances toward them with a sacred pollen, they kneel instinctively as though he was a god. Something happens when the masks begin to take a part in religious ritual. Masks were used in Egypt, we know, in the temple mysteries. And even today, the various carvings and manuscripts of Egyptian origin show human beings with the masks of birds and animals. The Greeks used masks in their theater also. Nearly always, a mask becomes a complete change of personality. If accompanied by adequate religious ritual, the mask becomes the secret of the development of a peculiar theological belief that there was a divine power in the mask. And when it was worn correctly and under ritual supervision, it brought a deity into contact with humanity. Well, in the course of time, the mask cults have gradually faded, but in many primitive countries, they still survive. Then came another step forward in the study of human psychology. It is almost impossible for the average person to understand a completely abstract principle. It is very hard to visualize something that has no form, or to visualize an energy which is completely unembodied. From very early times, it became apparently necessary to present nearly all of the important truths of life symbolically. We have wonderful symbolic books like Aesop's Fables or Pilgrim's Progress. We have very wonderful ancient sculpturing and statuary, paintings, carvings of all kinds, retablos and icons, which are presumed to have certain sacred value in themselves. You can go from one end of the world to the other among a middle-class group of people, the average person, and you ask them if they believe that these statues are actually divine or have spiritual power in themselves. And nearly everyone will answer no. Even in the midst of a vast array of this imagery, nearly everyone accepts the fact that it is symbolical, that it represents something that cannot be directly seen. It represents a power in nature, which is in itself invisible. The idea of this type of symbolism apparently arose from man's study of his own environment. It gradually dawned upon him that pure life, in its own essence, is invisible. We know it is present because of what it does, but we do not know what it is. Therefore, when we begin to study life, we have to do it by examining living things. We are not able to understand the substance of energy or vitality or force, but we are able to estimate its consequences. Therefore, as we look around us in nature, we see an infinite diversity of living things. All of these living things supported by one essential basic life principle. Under such conditions, it must become obvious that this life principle has many appearances. It has as many forms and appearances as forms and appearances exist in nature. It is not only represented by picture, it is represented by sound or color. It is represented by mathematical formulas and astronomical observations. And it is represented by now a very complex group of chemical and electronic symbols. And yet underneath all of this vast array of symbolism, it is obvious that there is one invisible life principle. And this principle, separated from all living things, is almost impossible to define. The only way we can define it is to reveal it through its own works. And our ancient forebears were certain that all creation was a revelation of one principle. Therefore, in order to make a diagram or a picture of this principle, something had to be found that could be equated with everything that exists. This symbol had to be inclusive enough to reveal the utter diversity of the divine power, and yet at the same time sufficiently integrated to realize or to represent the fact that this divine power was in the ultimate one, an indivisible principle, manifesting constantly through utter diversity. It therefore seemed quite proper to select various symbols to represent this one, indivisible but invisible unity at the source of existence. The Greeks had their pantheons of gods, so did the Egyptians and the Latins. The Hindus had a vast mass of celestial beings. Buddhism has its Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and Arhats. and nearly all religions and philosophies have behind the visible orders of things the concept of an invisible government, a government which controls all things, because it is by its very substance and essence in full possession of everything necessary for absolute leadership. All of this type of philosophy has gradually resulted in what we might term religious art. And this religious art is not limited to strange peoples far away. It is present in our own cathedrals and churches. Religious art is present in many private homes. Wonderful figures and representations of sacred persons or sanctified individuals are to be found in painting and in sculpturing in our own local environment. How then does it happen that we create this imagery? Artists, particularly in the early period of Gothic art in Europe, invented a complete language of symbolical attributes by means of which it would be possible to distinguish the degrees of sanctity or divinity present in the various representations that they made. Whether it is the great Michelangelo's Moses or the tremendous symbolical value of the Raphael and Rembrandt sacred paintings, it's always the same. A sacred picture to represent an invisible principle. Now, this is also the only way that we can represent the various virtues and vices of humanity. How are we going to define generosity to a person who has no understanding of the word? The only way we can understand under those conditions is through an action. And so we have the various parables and legends of scriptures. The Good Samaritan represents this kind of generosity. The wayward son who finally comes home to his family is in the parable of the prodigal son. Well, these are word patterns created to express virtues which are common to human beings, but which cannot be communicated without some relationship to a practical action. As we go into the pictures of religious personalities in all parts of the world, we are sometimes considerably confused. In many instances, it looks like some people have more of these images than might be necessary. We realize also that within cultures, these images change their appearances. They change the materials upon which or from which they are fashioned. They develop expressions and likenesses largely tribal or racial, and therefore differing in various areas and communities. Yet this tremendous, almost incalculable mass of sacred imagery is now becoming of great interest to not only the psychologist, but the anthropologist and the mystic, the metaphysician, and the symbolist in general, because these images tell us something. They tell us of man's eternal search for realities. And the very images which look unreal are part of this struggle to attain reality. Some time ago, an Indian gentleman, East Indian gentleman, was discussing with a missionary who was having a little difficulty trying to understand how this well-cultured Indian gentleman was able to respect an image with a number of arms and several heads. So he tried to explain this to the missionary. And he said, how now would you do some of these things? Suppose we say that a horse has a head, and a dog has a head, and a bird has a head, and a fish has a head. Now all these heads are parts of something. They are parts of life. All of these creatures are alive. One life is within them. Therefore, if we want to make a picture of life, we must make a cluster of living things to represent it. And no matter how many of these we put together or pile up, they will not be adequate. Because there will be more kinds of life than we can picture. There will be more attitudes and virtues within human life than we can depict. Therefore, the only thing we can do is to suggest that the divine power, the source of things, animates all life. And therefore, if we try to picture it, perhaps we should picture it made up of living things. In Egypt, the Serapian deity in the great Alexandrian library, the Serapeum, is said to have been a deity, a figure, made of a kind of wicker work. And within that wicker work were all forms of life, plants, flowers, symbols of animals and birds, all kinds of things. It was a wicker work filled with every type of life that the Egyptians could put in it. Therefore, to them, it seemed perfectly appropriate that this should represent the spirit of life, a spirit moving through living things, a spirit that should remind us forever of the unity of life and our own kinship with living things. So gradually it became increasingly practical, apparently, to create this elaborate pictorial representation of the various activities of natural law. In Alexandria, the astronomers tried to do this with the universe. The Brahmins perhaps did a little better at it, but all of them came to the realization that the universe was in some way an archetypal figure, a pattern, a picture. And if we wanted to picture the divine power, the source of life, what more adequate immediate symbol could be available than the solar system, the cosmos? There would be no way in which we could go beyond life. But everything we can reach is part of life. Therefore, life expands and extends. And as the Brahmins pointed out, the main problem with imagery is that it is inadequate. It is not that we have too much of it. It is that we cannot possibly have an imagery structure that is complete in all of its attributes. There was only a step then to take language as an example. Language was a way of putting forms into words and transmitting them. Language could go on and on and on, and never could we have enough words or enough language symbols to take care of everything we wanted to record. In the 15th and 16th century, the unabridged dictionary was a very slender little volume in English. Today, it is an inconceivably complicated volume. And still, there are not enough words to tell all that we know. In the same way, there are not enough symbols in nature to tell all that we believe about creation, about deity, about the infinite unfoldment of living things. So we find in the Greek and other religions also the gradual development of mythologies. These mythologies were stories about the gods, or about spirits, or ghosts, or superphysical beings of one kind or another. Now, in mythology, how were we going to symbolize the processes by means of which the various unfoldments of life took place? To the ancient people, without exception, generation was the most important symbol that existed to their knowledge, for it was a way in which life was perpetuated. It was the one way in which the mystery of death is solved forever in eternal life. Therefore, all the processes of creation that we might now carry on in a laboratory by means of chemicals or mathematical symbols were anciently represented by the ordinary activities of human life. Therefore, to the primitive people, deity was a tribal chieftain. Now, they knew he wasn't. There's no evidence whatever that the ancients were truly ignorant of this. All they knew was that they had to have a symbol. They had to have something. So deity had to be parent, because parent was the most important, valuable, and venerated thing in the material world. And as a family was a social unit to carry on the processes of life in this world, so it was only a step of understanding or interpretation to realize that the great collective, the entire cosmos, the absolute unity of all life, was also a family. And that by means of using the symbolism of family, we began to understand the motivations which might dominate creative processes. The family became, therefore, our natural home. Children respect their parents, admire them if they were worthy of admiration, sometimes even if they are not, because of traditional allegiances. But family, in all of its aspects, becomes a basis of culture. And the Chinese were especially avid in their symbolism, using the family as the symbol of the home, of the community, of the nation, of the race, of the universe. All these were families. All of them were ruled over by matriarchies or patriarchies. Another interesting point in connection with this is that as we go further and further back, the same thing happens that still occurs very frequently in family life, and that is gradually the mother takes the supreme position. The Emperor Julian, in his oration to the Mother of the Gods, and many other ancient symbols and systems, convey the clear indication that the maternal principle was the most important. In Egypt, all of the great families, especially the pharaohs, all were measured from the mother's side of the house. The name descended from the mother. And matriarchy was also the basic philosophical and political structure of the American Indians, especially the Iroquois League. Always the mother was the guardian, the brood, and the symbol of generation, procreation, and the fertility of God. Even today, it has been noted with some interest that in Christianity, there are very few, if any, known churches that are dedicated primarily to God the Father. They are all to either Christ or the Virgin Mary. Although, of course, later the saints come in, both male and female, into cathedral naming. But the great majority of religious belief in medieval Catholicism was centered upon Mary the Mother. In Japan and China, the Indian Bodhisattva, Avalokiteshvara, was a male being. But in Japan and China, it was feminized, and Mercy was personified as the goddess Kannon or Kuan Yin. And this was the mercy of the eternal. It was the attribute of everlastingness. And every virtue, every desirable quality, gradually became embodied in something. Embodied in a being that more or less exemplified all of the virtue of that particular attribute, whichever it might be. Wherever there was a great need for mercy, compassion, and understanding, the image of this power had to emerge as an experience of the people. They could not live without it. We also have other things that had to be personalized, such as justice. Justice, we know, is not a person. And yet justice has been personified many times in different nations and races by an appropriate symbol, very often the deity Jupiter or Zeus. Now, it so happens that from the mythology, Zeus might not have been all that justice ought to be. There are some reports to the contrary. But when we have justice here, it isn't always all that it ought to be. Wherever man created an image to represent a divine power, he embodied in it somewhere the weakness of himself. It couldn't be perfect. The image could never be the perfection. It could only be a symbol of something greater than itself. The human being, with his strength and his weakness, with his hopes and his fears, with his constant striving for security in a material existence, all these elements created theologies. They all created great systems of gods and godlings and angels suitable to bring certain ideas to the people. In the most of the ancient religions, there were what we call heroes. And heroes were ordinary mortals who, by some virtue, were lifted to an almost divine estate. The Greek heroes, such as Hercules and Ulysses, Achilles, and Orpheus, these were great hero beings. Yet they were born of the flesh. They were mortal, but they became immortal, and therefore became the immortal mortals. They inhabited a region between heaven and earth, and every faith and religion has had them in some form. Intercessors between man and that which was superior to himself. Also teachers, because every human being has to go to school. And when he graduates from a school here, it's obvious that he is not really enlightened. But he still has to study. Therefore, the concept of the school was expanded and extended, so that to the mystically minded, school lasted for the entire lifetime. And the most important experiences of schooling were those experienced in mature life. But actually, there were always teachers, always intercessors between the weak humanity and the divine power that fashioned all things. One good example of this intercession is found in Egypt. The one and only beloved son of Osiris, the god of the quick and the dead, was Horus, the hawk-headed. Not always represented with the hawk's head, however, but he was the head of the army of the sacred hawks, the Hesheshti, who were to fight the last great war against evil. And this being, Horus, appears with his father in the various papyri of the Book of the Dead. This was the book or manuscript buried with those who had passed on, and containing symbolically the story of the afterlife, which also became another very important system of symbolism. But in this particular case, the soul of the deceased comes into the hall of judgment to be weighed against truth. Now, it wasn't assumed that the deceased was perfect, and it was accepted, however, that certain imperfections were inevitable, but in the main and large, he must have kept the rules of human decency. He must have been honorable and honest. He must be able to recite the negative confession of faith without lying, exaggerating, or misrepresenting, because he was doing this in the presence of the jury. And our jury system is first seen on the Egyptian monuments, and has continued to the present time, with the judge in our system representing Osiris. Actually, when the soul was weighed and was found to be wanting a little too much, or not quite good enough for preservation in the land of the blessed, at that moment, Horus, this only begotten, came into the presence of his father and pled for the soul. He asked that Osiris take upon himself, that is, upon Horus, the son, the sin of the offending soul. Let him expiate the sin, and let the soul go on to peace. So this was part of the Egyptian ritual, because they had to have some of these things themselves. They had to explain life. They also had to explain what happens to their minds when the individual passed on. Where did he go? According to the Egyptian belief, if he was reasonably virtuous, he went into the Elysian fields. He went into the beautiful land of the blessed dead. But the fact that he went there did not necessarily change him. Because in the land of the dead, the Nile always overflowed its banks. The crop was always abundant. But the souls of the dead all worked. Death was not a symbol of sitting back somewhere and trying to play a musical instrument. Death was to live in a world as beautiful as Egypt, but ruled by divine law so that there could be no sin and no crime. And every individual had the right to earn his own way and have the security that he had earned, and nothing and no one could take it from him. So according to what he was, he went on to the fields of the blessed. And there's a story of the banker who, after a day, was an honest banker. He did very well. He passed the examination and went on to the afterlife. But he was a banker. And, of course, there's no banking over there. So he did. What was happening was very simple. After all, whether you're a banker or a farmer or anything else is all in yourself. You are what you believe you are. Therefore, this man believed he was a banker. And this, as a result of this believing, he found himself in the other world, seated comfortably at a table with his scales and everything in front of him, making money, changing currency, doing all the services of banking, and going on and enjoying life until it came time for him to come back again into embodiment. As an honest man, he became a happy banker. Because that's what he wanted to be. The priest wanted to be a better priest. The philosopher wanted to be a greater philosopher. But each life and each embodiment and each attainment was according to the need and to the acceptances of the person. The more advanced the individual was, the more lofty the afterlife. But where it was very simple, it could still be very beautiful. And the Egyptians figured that the farmer had just as good a heaven and just as much happiness as the greatest priest. Each was in the condition that fulfilled its own needs. And these needs, as they grew and expanded through time, were fulfilled by right conduct. So all this symbolism is found carved on the temple walls, found in the ancient manuscripts, and in the records that have descended from scholars who lived in those days. Thus we have all kinds of symbols. We have everything that is necessary to some way make life significant to the person. Today we have a great belief and a great need of believing in integrities that are more important than the mistakes that we make every day. But in the course of time, something has happened that is a little unfortunate, I think, because others may disagree with me. I think it's a misfortune that we have lost this world of fairy tales, this world of symbols, this marvelous, adventurous realm in which virtue does survive and does succeed, and those who live well live happily ever after. This world was part of something that was a deeper believing than we have today, and probably came nearer to believing true than the beliefs that we do cherish in our modern society. There seems to be a lack of the love of beauty, of the recognition of the divine warmth of existence. We have become so interested in laws, so interested in processes, so much concerned with computerizations, that we have forgotten the beauty, the dignity of a universe of gentle, constructive emotions, a universe in which love and friendship and understanding, security, mutual helpfulness were the great ideas and the great ideals. Now, where you had a mystical theology, it was easy to sustain those concepts, even though some, of course, always disobeyed them. But the general group of persons lived hopefully and lived with a full understanding that somewhere in space there was an orderliness which would protect and preserve them. Their belief in God made them sharers in a divinely guided world, a universe of eternal benevolence. As we gradually lost track of this, as the gods seemed to retire to their distant Olympian thrones, and the world was left open to politicians and economists and industrialists, something went wrong. The wonderful overtones were lost and are now generally regarded as superstitions. It is considered now a superstition to believe in the presence of this eternally divine power. And yet, if we look out at life and get a little ways off from our own narrow particulars with which we are concerned, this universe of beauty, this universe of love and friendship, this universe of life does still exist. It is everywhere. Every natural process that makes up the vast pageantry of existence is essentially a beautiful process. It is meritorious. It is gentle. It is kind. And all the mistakes that we make some way get cleared up. We do solve the problems. We do go on. And most persons do dream of life to come and of better conditions than they know now. All of this was a heritage from the past. It was all believed. And people lived according to it. Today, your anthropologist will say that they were very childish. And yet, maybe they were childish. But Jesus said of children, that of them is the kingdom of God. And the same thought occurs in the writings of Chinese philosophers, especially Mencius and Lao Tzu. The child heart is the thing we have lost. And we've lost with it the fairy tale and the legend. We've lost Hans Christian Andersen and the Brothers Grimm. We have lost a world of fantasy, which unfortunately faded away but has never actually been disproved. That there might be beauty that we don't recognize, that there may be love that we don't know how to experience. These things are there, but we have gradually lost contact with them. I remember Burbank told me one afternoon in Santa Rosa, he said, you think you've got five senses and that you're pretty smart because you have them. And I'm convinced that he, from my own researches, that animals and plants have more than 20 sensory perceptions, more than we have, but not focused in the same level as ours. They have the worlds of their own. And in those worlds, laws that are beautiful and kind and good are operating. We may not be able to understand them. And our treatment of these various creatures does not show understanding in many instances. But that all forms of life have hope, have some internal power within themselves. Burbank used to talk to his plants, and they did what he wanted them to. They sent students from the universities up to Santa Rosa, and they did everything that Burbank did, but they wouldn't bother to talk to the plants. And theirs died. The only one, apparently, who was ever able to really carry it on successfully was an old Chinese gardener that Burbank had. The Chinese gardener got down on his knees and had heart-to-heart talks with the calla lily, and it did what he wanted it to do. But all the hive specialized students with great knowledges of botany and horticulture got nowhere. And the world of make-believe, so-called, is very largely a world of love, a world in which things are more beautiful than we thought they were, a world in which something very warm and very close, very divine, is near us at all times. And our ancient forebears were really almost able to see these things. I remember these in one of the dialogues of Socrates, that he and his disciples gathered in a grove by the side of the road to have scholarly discourse. And Socrates asked the disciples to join him in prayer. to the muses and the nymphs and the hamadryads in that woods that they would come and share knowledge with him. He believed in these things, and he was one of the world's great philosophical thinkers. We have gradually cut off the invisible. We have made it so unreal. And why have we done this? Because we feel that we have outgrown the old symbolism. We feel that the imagery of the past was not good enough, or that we have outgrown the idea that the gods of India gathered in session on the peak of Meru. We do not believe these things, nor do we believe that they were on the peak of Olympus, because too many people now have climbed Olympus and there's nothing there. So that ends the whole thing. But what all these people have forgotten or overlooked in the whole situation is the tremendous symbolism of it. It wasn't the physical Olympus where the gods lived. It was a symbol of a superior or higher state of consciousness, something that rose like a majestic mountain peak with snow and glaciers, something on which the light of the sun shone in many colors. There was a symbolic mountain, a mysterious place somewhere, the axle of the world, where divinity dwelt. And people really believed this. And in some way, they were better for that belief. It was much better for them to have those kind of beliefs because they carried with them certain responsibilities and duties. When you believed in the reality of things unseen, you had to obey what you believe. You had to have courage to live well. If there were gods, you had to so abide with your neighbor that these gods would not punish you, but would reward you with proper abundance and security. Among the American Indians, the Siberian shaman, the Shinto of Japan, and many of the folk beliefs of Africa, we had the story of the medicine priest, the born mystic who was the leader of the tribe. In almost all ancient communities, the mystics were the leaders because they were the ones that could speak with the gods. They were the Irish mystics that were able to go into the world of the fairy people under the earth and would carry messages back and forth. Among the Hopis, the snake people carry the messages of man to the earth mother. And the Thunderbird raises the messages to the Sky Father. All these things are legends, but they stand for something. They stand for thoughtfulness, for some kind of inner experience of communion.
Please turn your cassette to the other side now, and it will continue to play after a brief pause.